I'm Scott Denton, alternate host of KUNM's Thursday afternoon Freeform, and I am pleased to be joined on the phone by acclaimed singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams, currently touring in support of her 11th studio album, Down Where the Spirit Meets the Bone. She'll perform at the Lensic in Santa Fe on February 18th. Lucinda, thanks so much for taking the time to chat.
Thanks for having me.
And our deepest condolences on the recent loss of your father, renowned poet, Miller Williams.
Thank you.
I've been a fan since first hearing Side of the Road on a mixtape a friend made for me, probably about 25 years ago. So I've been in the choir a long time, but this album stopped me in my tracks.
Over
100 minutes of music, 20 songs, and all keepers. You had to start your own label to finally release a double album?
The thing is, my contract was already up with Lost Highway anyway at that point, so I had to shop around for a while, you know, mm-hmm. decide who I wanted to go with, and ended up doing a deal with 30 Tigers, and they're based in Nashville, and they're independent, and just a bunch of great people. And one of the things we told them we wanted to do is be able to start, have our own label under the umbrella of 30 Tigers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I still had a lot of creative freedom at Lost Highway, but, you know, it's a little different now because it's all independent and they're more open, too, to, you know, doing different things.
Yeah. Well, despite the freedom that you did have with Lost Highway, the one thing I know you've spoken of being frustrated by was when you had a batch of songs for West, you know, you
mm-hmm.
couldn't do that. They didn't want to go with the double
yeah.
album.
And for business reasons or whatever.
Commercial reasons, yeah. So you've got a batch of songs that are from a period, and you sort of have to then set some aside and see them come out on the next
mm-hmm.
album, which, of course, would be Little Honey. Kind of a little bit of irony, even a kind of humorous note. So you guys apparently go into do these sessions, and they go so well that you had even more than you released. So you sort of had to self-impose a similar restriction.
That's going to come out. That's going to come out, you know, sooner than if we. I mean, it's going to come out sometime later this year.
Oh, great!
You know?
I'm looking forward to that.
So it'll follow this album, you know. So it'll kind of be sort of like part two.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
you've attributed this past decade's increased prolificness. Or prolificacy, I've never figured out which is the best noun to use for that word, but to a kind of a cathartic release, you know, that partly at least, if not entirely, related to your mother's death in 2004. Have
mm-hmm.
you, reading about that, reading you talking about that, intrigued me, and it made me curious about, besides intuitively understanding that that's what was going on for you, have you been able to put your finger a little bit more on how that actually worked?
Being more prolific, you mean?
Right, as a function of your catharsis.
Yeah, it's still a little bit of a mystery because I don't think anyone knows, you know, why all of a sudden they're more prolific. You know, I guess I could attribute it to being older, getting better at my craft.
Sure.
You know, just kind of the more you do it, you know, the better you get kind of thing, maybe more confidence as a writer,
mm-hmm.
You know, giving myself more permission to, you know, do different things as a writer and try different things and just, you know, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
As we go along in life, we experience more loss and, you know, more heavy events that can lend themselves to more, I guess, more to our creativity, you know, and
sure.
that sort of thing.
The well gets deeper as we get older.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. This new album, it's not as though it's outside of the trajectory I would have always expected from you, but it has not only in you and your writing and your singing, the team of veterans playing the music, I think it winds up being a function of the fact that you had the freedom to go with a double
mm-hmm.
album. You didn't have to start thinking about cutting a 5-minute song down that has great guitar solo, fading it out, and everything could play out.
I've always loved, I love guitar and, you know, guitar sounds. You know, this I was really happy to be able to, you know, feature so many different great guitarists on the album, and they're all equally great and all different. They all add different things to the songs.
Yes.
And one of the things that made this album so different, too, and that's the same thing you're talking about, is usually I go in with my road band and cut all the songs. I might have a few guest artists come in and, you know, overdub a few things here and there, but this was the first time I actually worked with a different rhythm section. Still worked with my guys who I tour with, Butch mm-hmm. Norton and David Sutton, but I also brought in Davey Farragher and Pete Thomas, who play with Elvis Costello.
Right.
His legendary rhythm section. And so that really gave the song, different songs a different kind of vibe and feel and everything. I actually had a couple of other different bass players, too. Besides, we had Davey Farragher, we had my guy, David Sutton, we had Bob Glob on one song, and then we had Sebastian, who was the bass player in Soul Coffee.
Right.
He came in and played on one track. And
mm-hmm. And did that?
And everybody loved playing together. Everybody, it was just, you know, it was a great time. And
the little video on your website really conveys that. You co-produced with your husband, Tom Overby, and manager and music executive, and the great Greg Lease,
mm-hmm.
multi-instrumentalist, great guitar player, of course, and I assume a studio whiz.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why we brought him in as co-producer. It didn't start out that way, but Greg ended up just being so, you know, helpful, and we just kind of started collaborating just organically mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. studio. And I said to Tom, you know, we need to make Greg an official co-producer, you know,
because uh-huh.
that's what was happening. So
then on the guitarists, he's, of course, a formidable guitar player. Did Doug Pettibone play on this record?
Yeah, he came in.
He did, too.
And played mm-hmm. Played on some stuff. And
so I'm curious, as a listener, I just, you know, part of what really just slays me about this album, as I said, is that the guitar work, among other things we'll get to. But so some of the stuff, it sounds like I'm hearing, you know, on some tracks, like, for example, I just love East Side of Town. And the guitar work on that is so beautiful and goosebump producing, you know. And it sounds like I'm hearing two guitarists. So was there overdubbing, or is that Doug and Stuart Mathis, or?
It was Greg and Stuart.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Tom's right here, so he's kind of he's kind of filling in.
Okay, and then I'll bet that's the case.
It was Stuart Mathis and Greg Lease, on that one.
And I'll bet that's the case.
And it was live, too.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Thing. Everything was cut live.
That,
I mean, we had a couple of things, you know, here and there were overdubs, but for the most part, it was all live.
I thought so, because it just sounds,
mm-hmm.
it has that sound.
Yeah.
And then the soul sound, the Southern soul thing. I know you've mentioned this, where I've read that it sounds like that also wasn't so much an intentional thing as a kind of an organic process.
Yeah. You know, I've always loved country soul, as I refer to it now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like the great Tony Joe White
yes.
songs, and the Dusty in Memphis album that was recorded at Muscle Shoals, and the great Dan Penn songs and all of that, you
sure.
know.
Dark End of the Street.
You know, Dark End of the Street, yeah. So, and, you know, I'd been listening. They just released this double CD collection of stuff from the Fame Studios, you know, and
mm-hmm.
all the Dan Penn songs and everything.
Oh, really?
So I'd been right before, as I was writing some of the stuff, so that was kind of seeping into me, into my, you know, subconscious or whatever.
Sure.
And sometimes that, you know, depending on what I've been listening to, you know, for a while, that can kind of influence, you know, my writing and everything. So, but also I've always wanted to, you know, cut songs more kind of like in that vein.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well,
know?
I was just
in that mood, you know, to do, and maybe that's what I was talking about before. Like now I've just, as I've grown as a writer, I'm learning more how to, as a singer and a songwriter, how to, you know, write those kind of songs more, you know.
Give yourself the freedom to follow what
yeah.
is an organic
yeah.
groove kind
it's
of.
It's hard when you're just sitting down with a guitar by yourself, you know, coming up with like a heavy rock song, you know.
Sure.
You know, the natural inclination is just kind of sit and by yourself and write a ballad or, you know, a country song, maybe a blues song or something like that, you know. So
a lot of this sound grew out of the collaboration that was going on.
Yeah. once we got in the studio. And, I kind of have a feel of how I wanted the song to be in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until we got in there that, we would. And it's when I'm in the studio recording, too, it's a very organic process and, very democratic, if you will, process. I like everybody to get involved and, talk about, toss ideas around and all of that. And, when you're working with musicians of that caliber, too, it's so great because, they're all just so brilliant.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
They have such a great history. Everybody understands the history of all the,
right.
The behind the music and all. So, you can talk about it. And I remember I talk a lot with Pete Thomas about like the vibe that I wanted on a certain song or something. And I'd kind of play sing something and he would play something on the drums and I'd go, yes, that's it.
There it is. Right.
he would say like, oh, you mean like sort of that vibe of Son of a Preacher Man,
yeah.
And he'd play the something, on the drums,
mm-hmm.
and I'd go, that's it,
yeah.
So you have to have a sort of a reference point,
Exactly,
because you don't want the song, you're not trying to have it sound like that song.
No.
But, you've got to have a reference point, something to work from. That's how we would approach everything.
I mean, and it worked. This album could be the basis of a graduate seminar on Southern country soul. This week we're going to talk about Muscle Shoals. This week we're going to talk about Memphis. This week we're going to talk about the Dusty in Memphis album or whatever, Dan Penn.
Mm-hmm.
But all those elements, the addition of the gospel-inflected backing vocals, the horns, here and there, and we can't fail to mention, the late Ian McLagan's great organ playing.
God, that was such a shock.
Yeah,
I mean,
it must have been.
Nobody was prepared for that.
Yeah, just an
old... He was so great in the studio. He was just as alive as anything, and he was just happy. And, he was Mac. He was, just full of joy. And
yeah.
He had a heart condition shortly before he came to the studio. He just had to have an emergency stent put in. Then, we're all thinking, okay, everything's fine now. Then apparently he, at some point later, he was having some complications and he was having some headaches and he didn't know that it was related to his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had suffered a massive stroke.
Massive, right, yeah. Yeah, his playing is so beautiful and it's so Muscle Shoals, that organ,
mm-hmm.
that organ sound. And yet, it doesn't sound like, oh, let's get a little Muscle Shoals organ here. It's coming from everybody's soul. And because, as you're saying, and that's what I love about the album, there's just this relaxed virtuosity,
mm-hmm.
It's like what comes with age, we get to know how to take our time.
Exactly.
And everybody
was older pretty much. He played on the album.
Yeah,
and
this album shows, that for all that this album is with respect to the Southern country soul sound and all of that, too, it's just a badass rock and roll album.
Well, I appreciate that.
There's also, on a few songs like Walk On and Stowaway in Your Heart, a little bit of almost Brill Building or Doc Pomus type of songwriting.
It's so cool you picked up on that. Yeah, that's exactly, especially on Walk On, that was what I was thinking. After I wrote that song, it reminded me of that.
Yeah,
songs that from that era, some of the Carole King stuff.
Exactly, the stuff that it wasn't so wasn't the Southern thing going on, but it was a soulful.
But I was into that too. That's
sure.
the thing. I mean, the era I grew up in. I mean, so many different styles of music inspired me.
Exactly, and we heard
and
it.
I loved the '60s pop songs.
Yeah,
like the Tula Clark's Downtown.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. All of that. I was just trying to. I wanted to do something that was a little more. I didn't want to. I don't like to do the same album over again.
Yeah.
And
that probably, as you were saying, by switching up the rhythm section a little bit, might have opened some doors.
Oh, yeah.
Making that easier.
Yeah, definitely.
Speaking of musical connections and Doc Pomus, all of these things we've been discussing, they're hardly surprising that they're playing a part in your musical diet over your lifetime. Doc Pomus brings up an interesting connection. I know that one of two covers that are going to be on the forthcoming album is Lou Reed's Pale Blue Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Lou was mentored by Doc Pomus. He was kind of got his break in songwriting, publishing and stuff in the 60s. Pomus was sort of a mentor to him. And I couldn't resist that connection. How did the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed figure in your listening as you were when you were younger and coming up?
Well, they were another one that was just, you know, that made a huge impact on me. I mean, that one particular album.
Which one?
Had that song on it.
The third album.
Yeah.
Yeah, the self-titled.
Yeah. Yeah, and just, I mean, the whole vibe of it, you know, it's just so plain and simple, but haunting and just,
yeah, yeah.
You know, the spaciousness that's in it and everything.
And I think that had a lot to do with Lou's songwriting really coming to the fore on that record. You know, it was more of a pop,
mm-hmm.
less noisy and avant-garde than you know, the previous stuff.
I liked the earlier stuff better. Yeah, and I'll Be Your Mirror, and
there's killer songs
on
that.
I mean, because I was also really into Jim Morrison and the Doors, but you know, for the same reason, because it was again just that real stripped down thing, you know, and you know, because some of the songs like the Doors' Crystal Ship, and you know, I mean, they were like, and some of Lou's songs like Pale Blue Eyes. I mean, that could be, you know, like a singer-songwriter song. I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
And you know, that's what it is, basically.
I think that's what he learned from Doc Pomus. You know, and I mean, I had the gift already, obviously, too. But I think, you know, Lou worked in a publishing house was right out of college, and you know, where they would the kind of thing where they'd come in and say, hey, we need a dozen surf songs, you know, and these guys would just they'd have to get really good at cranking out the 2.5 minute hooks. And I've always thought, mm-hmm. I've never heard him say so or anything, but I've always thought that figured deeply in Lou's songwriting and ability with hooks like that.
That's what it is, yeah. Linger On, Pale Blue Eyes, Linger On Your Pale Blue Eyes. And I loved the style of that song, then backed by this, you know, edgy rock kind of moody, dark band, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The combination of that.
Are you aware there is just released a 45th anniversary super deluxe edition of that record, the third album? And what's really interesting is two discs of live material from 1969, and it's all remastered, and it sounds amazing. And it, because
yeah,
it was,
we have it.
Good, yeah, it's a great album.
Tom bought it.
Yeah, he's holding it up now. In fact, I just did a late night show and I played the 36-minute version of Sister Ray. But it's not like the old one with Cale. It's not scratchy and noisy. It's pop. It sounds, and you hear those guys laying the groundwork for two guitar bands that would come, you know, like Television and Luna and so on.
Anyway, I love Television. We cut it because, you know, Lou had passed away during the time we were in the studio.
Oh, yeah.
And I had always loved that song and, you know, had already knew it. And so, you know, Tom said, let's cut it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. We had Bill Frisell there, too.
Ooh. Oh, man.
So, yeah.
Oh, I can't wait.
So he's on it, yeah.
Well, yeah, and Magnolia. What a closer. What a closer. I just, that song again, you know, with Frizzell and the track preceding it, One More Day.
Yeah,
that's
you know, one of my favorite ones.
And it's probably one of the most, has the most pronounced Muscle Shoals aspect to it that I wound up, I was playing it on a show, on a daytime show a while back, and I think I followed it up with something from St. Paul and the Broken Bones. You know those guys?
I know the name,
yeah,
but I'm not real familiar with their stuff.
Well, they're and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, too. There's kind of a new young crop of Southern soul, rock, country soul bands. They are one of them. These guys.
Okay,
it's
like I'm definitely going to check them out.
Six white guys from Alabama. I think Birmingham.
Okay.
And the singer sounds like Al Green.
Wow.
It's awesome stuff.
You know, there's another band of young guys called Vintage Trouble.
I haven't heard of them.
And, you know, they're doing that kind of thing, too.
Yeah, and then, you know, Alabama Shakes, and, it's kind of a little renaissance of Southern soul.
It is, yeah, it's great.
You have said over all your life, and, you know, you've talked about wanting to adapt one of your father's poems to a song.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was always a struggle. And with your husband's urging, evidently, you know, you went ahead and did that. The opening track on this album, Compassion, is in fact an adaptation of one of his poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love the story, the anecdote you've told about how he always maintained with you as a teenager and his creative writing students that there was a very clear distinction between a songwriter and a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And you've spoken of finally understanding that now that you've done the adaptation.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what it is. What is that difference?
Well, the main thing is, I mean, when I went in to do that on this song, because the poem is very short and concise, and, you know, you can't just go in and just slap a melody on it the way it stands. So I had to figure out kind of how to stretch the poem out.
Mm-hmm.
So what I ended up doing was just kind of moving, they're all the original words, but kind of just moving around a couple of words here and there, just rephrasing a couple of things and repeating some of the lines.
Mm-hmm,
so, you
right.
know, in order to make it into kind of verses, you know, with a kind of a refrain or a hook
mm-hmm.
kind of a thing, you know, so, because that's, you know, that's generally the way you build a song. And I guess it depends on the poem, too. Some poems are written more in that traditional rhyme way.
Right.
You know, but, you know, most poems are, a lot of poems aren't. So they're just, there isn't really, you know, the meter is just so completely different.
Mm-hmm. For the next attempt, are you going to look for something that's more of a, has more of a rhyme structure?
Well, his stuff doesn't, he doesn't really do that. There's another poem, and it's a much longer, more involved poem that's the one that I've been working on off and on for years, trying to do something with it, because I love the poem so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Why Does God Permit Evil? And I still haven't been able to do it with that one.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I've kind of, since I went in and, you know, challenged myself and managed to do it on the poem Compassion, I think I've kind of figured out some stuff
mm-hmm.
as I was doing that one. So now I'm going to go back and see if I can do something with some of the other ones.
Just another aspect of that aging and growth and mm-hmm. confidence, right? I mean, your father's poetry, I mean, I can, aside from the technical things you've discussed, I mean, there was probably just an impediment that now having done it is gone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I'm constantly learning and growing still.
Sure, yeah.
You know,
well,
I mean,
and
thank God, you know.
Yeah.
But some, you know, everybody's different. Some people, I guess, they just get to a certain point and they kind of just get comfortable with that and, you know, that's it. But, you know, I like to think of myself. You know, my dad always said, never lose your sense of wonder.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
That's one of the many things he taught me, you know, just, you know, and I never have. So, I mean, I think that's what keeps you young.
I think so, too. And it's abundantly evident on the album, and it has been with you. And besides just the sort of organic growth in confidence and those sorts of things, you've talked about figuring out how to write for your voice as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's another, yeah, that's a really important thing I've learned over the years.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
Does that involve just certain keys even and things of that nature?
Yeah, just certain keys. And my voice is better than it was when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I agree.
Learn to use my limitations, you know, to work with my limitations, and which means, you know, just figuring out what your voice can do or not do and work around that and not feel, you know, held back by it, but just, you know, it can make your voice stronger or make you stronger as
exactly.
a singer.
Well, idiosyncrasies become characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So,
I remember I was doing a show with Emmylou Harris one time years ago, and we went into a restaurant to have some dinner, and there was someone in there singing light opera. And I turned to Emmy and said, oh, boy, I wish I had a range like that, you know. And she said, oh, you just, you know, you're fine. You just, you know, make your limitations work for you.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, and because I always wanted to be able to have a range like Emmylou, you know, too.
Mm-hmm.
Joni Mitchell and all those, because, you know, those were all the singers, the, you know, the female singer-songwriters I grew up listening
right.
to all had these beautiful, high, you know, gorgeous voices.
Yes.
You know, Joan Baez and Judy Collins and Emmy and Joni Mitchell and, you know.
Of course.
And I couldn't sing like that.
No, and.
But then I discovered Bobby Gentry.
Yes, exactly. You've certainly, I mean, you have an indelible voice. Thank goodness you learned how to write for it, and you're not still later in life trying to write, you know, trying to sing like any of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So as a fan, I'm very grateful that you have figured that out, and it's very clear. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time and mention again that Lucinda Williams and her band will be at the Santa Fe Lensic Theater in February on the 18th. Who can we expect to see in the touring band?
My rhythm section, Butch Norton and David Sutton, and Stuart Mathis is going to be with us on guitar. Yeah.
Just the four of you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great news, because I haven't gotten to see him play with you. It's been Doug Pettibone the last couple of times. And his play,
yeah.
I didn't really realize what an awesome guitarist Stuart Mathis was until... I haven't been that big a Wallflowers fan, so I wasn't aware. I'm like, whoa, where'd this guy come from?
They're kind of on hiatus right now, you know, so... And, you know, he's been doing different things. He was touring with Marian Faithful for a while.
Well, again, thank you, Lucinda, so much for taking the time to talk with us. We will look forward to the show here in Santa Fe and spinning the record here at KUNM.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, you too. Bye.